So we have an opportunity this evening to take some time to reflect on the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha, and how it relates to our own lives. This human existence that we share. And I'm very conscious this evening that I look a bit different. Some of you might not be able to see, but I've got a black eye. And so I thought I should probably explain that as a sort of starting point, because it's the kind of thing that people either are too polite to ask about. We're very good at pretending not to notice these things, or else they do ask, and I have to tell the same story over and over again. So I'll begin by telling the story of my black eye. Happened on Thursday night, when I was asleep, actually. And I was kind of in one of those sort of states where I wasn't quite sure where I was. And I have quite a high bed, actually. It's higher than this seat. And at one point, I just put my hand down to kind of lean to go somewhere or something. I don't know what I was doing. And the next thing I knew, I was on the floor with a very sore cheekbone. So that's how it happened. One of those sort of rather strange accidents. And you know, I was realizing that when we have things like this happen to us, we can make all kinds of dramas about it. You know, we can you know, wonder if we're ever going to recover and be all right. We can get into that. And we can also sort of wonder whether this is an inauspicious sign, you know, something I'm doing wrong in my practice. And that maybe it's a kind of warning that about something or other. And we can create all kinds of stories around the things that happen to us. And one of the things I realize is that that really, with things like this, we really don't know. We really don't know. And perhaps the most helpful thing is, rather than kind of blaming ourselves or blaming somebody else or worrying about whether somebody's sort of put a curse on us or something, is actually just to come into the heart and say to ourselves with great kindness, like for me, I'd say, Chandasiri, may you be well. And I was talking with someone today and just sort of came to the realization that this is actually one of the most helpful mantras for each of us, as a way of just bringing us into a particular relationship with ourselves in our human existence. One of the things that came to mind, actually, just when we were sitting here, was a line from the Buddha's words on loving kindness. Just as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. And I was realizing that in our lives, I mean, often we kind of wait for somebody else to be gentle and kind with us. But actually, we can be gentle and kind with ourselves in this way. And for myself, I realized that this is actually a much more helpful response to some of the difficult things that happen to us, whether some kind of physical injury or some kind of really painful, difficult situation that we find ourselves in, or if somebody's mean to us, or if we make a fool of ourselves. I mean, it seems to cover every possible thing that can happen to us. It's just to sort of stop for a moment and say, Chandasiri, may you be well. It goes against our usual habit. Our usual habit is to go straight up into our head, try to explain, try to justify, worrying, feeling anxious, feeling concerned, feeling upset, creating some kind of a story about it, whereas just, Chandasiri, may you be well, brings you into a particular sense of presence. Like a mother with her child, newborn baby, who needs our full attention, our full care, our full concern and interest. Not an intellectual thing, not something we think or plan, but a very, very immediate kind of concern and relationship. So that was one of the things I was thinking about. One might be concerned that this leads us into a state of being totally selfish, totally preoccupied with ourselves. But one of the useful things to consider alongside this sense of well-wishing towards ourselves is to actually consider what conditions actually support well-being in our lives. And to realize that actually selfishness is not a very happy state of affairs. You know, may I be well and to heck with the rest of you. Or may I be well, but may that person who's hurt me or who's upset me, may they go to hell. These kind of thoughts don't conduce to a sense of happiness and well-being. And I'm not saying that any of you does that at all. But I notice in my own mind that sometimes, you know, if I've been hurt, that I can get into a sense of wishing that the person who's hurt me or humiliated me, or I think they've humiliated me, that they may somehow suffer or be humiliated or something. And just considering the teachings of the Buddha, you know, just as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart, let one cherish all living beings. As the Buddha's words on loving kindness. And these teachings, this guidance, was given to support a process of liberation, a process of liberation from all suffering. This state that each one of us has the potential to realize, a state of liberation from all suffering. As our practice goes on, and as we become more attuned to the ways that we suffer, the ways that we cause difficulties for ourselves, what I've found is that quite naturally there's a growing sense of empathy for the suffering of others, a growing interest in the welfare of all beings. You know, my brothers and sisters in the holy life, the people who come to the monastery, who stay in the monastery, people that one hears about in the world, just a sense, you know, may all beings be well. And then the creatures. I mean, some of you may know that I spent some weeks up in Scotland recently during the winter retreat. Recently, a property has been purchased which will be a hermitage, a place for the community of nuns, where, not that we're all going to go and move there, but a place that people will be able to spend time and eventually perhaps to have a small group of us resident up there. And so I had a chance to spend 7 weeks up at this place up near Cobbery, up in Perthshire, just north of Edinburgh and Glasgow. Very, very beautiful part of Britain. And it's beautiful to look at, and the sounds are beautiful. And one of the things that I found incredibly beautiful was the air, incredible fragrance on the air. You sort of, you know, you go outside and you just breathe, and this sort of quite remarkable. I mean, I find Amarawati air pretty beautiful, but that's much more beautiful even than the Amarawati air. So it's very lovely. So I was very happy to spend a few weeks there. And one of the things that I found that living in a kind of fairly remote, wild part of the country where, and there's quite a lot of farm animals, there's quite a lot of people who farm with sheep and cattle, and there are also wild creatures, deer, birds, different kinds of birds. And somebody asked me how my time had been there, you know, how it was going. And I think one of the most powerful contemplations was just the contemplation of death, actually. Because when you live in countryside like that, you come across many creatures who've died. And fairly soon after I arrived, I found this little deer that had got its head stuck in a fence and had obviously had a terrible struggle and then died. And it was very, I felt very sad. I still feel sad, actually, when I think about it, bring the image to mind. There's something very pathetic about this feeling of being trapped and struggling. And over the weeks I was there, I would go back and I would just contemplate this little form and notice how it changed over the days. And by the time I left, it was still obviously a deer, but the corpse was very, very changed. And remembering that the Buddha encourages us to really take every opportunity to contemplate our own mortality. So this was actually looking at the deer and then contemplating my mortality, the sense that I too have a form that is vulnerable. I may live to a ripe old age and till all the organs have worn out and it just kind of stops, something stops, and there's the end of the life, or I may have a more serious accident and die that way, or I may develop some kind of illness and die that way. But one thing is certain is that it's going to perish. And then, just like that small deer, the body will change. I mean, maybe I'll be cremated, I don't know, in which case, it'll have a week or so to change, and you can all come and contemplate me in the Chapel of Rest. Or maybe, maybe I'll be buried and it'll change gradually under the ground. But one way or another, this physical form will cease to be, what I call me. It'll no longer be Sister Chandasiri. I mean, one of the things that people often say when they contemplate a corpse is, it might be somebody they know and love very much, and they will say, after a few days, the person isn't there anymore. It's just a corpse. And so, during my time at Miltiyum, there were several dead creatures. There was a sheep that had died giving birth. It was just in a ditch. And that was very pathetic too, very sad. And a pheasant that had been hit by a car, obviously, that was just in the road, that I picked up and moved, and just the sort of feeling of the animal, and there was a sort of moisture there, because it was not long dead, it was a little bit warm. And, one might sort of think, ugh, how revolting. But it all felt just very normal, very natural. And then contemplating Miltiyum as a place for practice. I looked for 3 or 4 years actually to find somewhere that I felt would be a suitable place for the nuns, a place that that we could, meditate and develop our practice, and where we could have a small community, a place that there was sufficiently remote to be able to not be disturbed. This is one of the things that the Buddha recommended when he was you know, considering places for his monks to live, a place that wasn't, you know, too close to the city where one would be disturbed by city life, and but also within reach where people could come and make offerings, or where the monks and nuns could go and go for alms. And in generally a place that would be conducive. And eventually this place was found. And then arriving there and having a chance to spend some weeks practicing. And yeah, I was really very grateful that the community was able to let me do that, you know, that I wasn't indispensable, I was able to go. And it was interesting comparing it with, you know, places like Amaranwati and Chithurst, which have been established for decades, where people have been meditating for many, many years, and realizing that a place of practice, you know, partly it's the environment, you know, having a place that's beautiful, that's close to nature, that is free from, you know, major disturbances, but that a place of practice, it takes time. So in fact, you know, having arrived there and sort of sitting in meditation, I noticed my mind, it didn't settle so much. It wasn't as calm as it is when I come to the temple here or when I sit in the retreat center shrine room. And realizing that it takes time. So certainly over the time I was there, it sort of settled more and more and more. And, you know, there were certain places where it felt calmer and other places where it felt less calm. And then just noticing coming back here, you know, a sort of sense of just an appreciation for what we have here. You know, this monastery here, which is, you know, it was 1984 that we first arrived, and it had been a school for, you know, disturbed, emotionally disturbed children. You know, realizing that it's taken many, many years of practice and people just living here, maybe, you know, not feeling, I mean, we've all been through our stuff, those of us who've been here for a long, long time, it hasn't always felt calm and peaceful, but just the sort of effort to apply ourselves to the practice, just the effort to stay present, to stay steady, this practice with this attitude of letting go, and, you know, this determination to keep beginning again, you know, not carrying the past into the present, you know, not lingering in states of grudges or aversion or negativity, or not being over-concerned or preoccupied about what's going to happen next, but making, you know, this mindfulness, this continually coming back to the next breath, making that the priority of our lives. You know, one can really feel the effects of that coming back. And many people have said when they come here, I mean, even, you know, people who don't really meditate, they say, oh, this is such a peaceful place, you know, to be able to come here and sit quietly. And I was chatting with somebody the other day who'd just sort of come for the first time, and, you know, I said, well, you know, oh no, it was, where was it? Can't remember, but anyway, it was somewhere, and I met somebody, oh, it was the doctor, yeah, I went to see the doctor. And she said, oh, you know, I've met many of the one of you who come from the monastery, and I said, well, you come and visit. She said, oh, really? And I said, yes, any time, come, you know, just come, sit in the temple. And just realizing that, you know, just people's efforts in practicing actually creates a sort of sanctuary, creates a refuge, a place where many, many people can come and just sit and enjoy the atmosphere of calm, of quiet, and be supported in establishing for themselves that sense of presence. And just allow all the kind of preoccupations, the concerns, the worries, the difficulty, the pain, the sorrow of their lives, just allow it all just to settle here. So Milne-Thiom is very young as a monastic residence, you know, just a few months, and it hasn't had many person hours of meditation there yet. But you know, my wishes or my hope is that, you know, over the years, you know, that people will have a chance to be there and to spend time there and to be supported in their practice, and also to help to create a sanctuary, a place where people can come and can benefit from these teachings, this way of practice. One of the things that became very obvious during the weeks I was there, and it was actually something that I've had an interest and concern about right from the start, was a sense that a monastery, just as Amarawati and the same as Chithurst, it exists in a context. So there's the monastic residence, there's the land, the property, and there's also the surrounding countryside, the people who live around about. And you know, some of them are perhaps Buddhist practitioners. I know at Chithurst and around here too, there are many Buddhist practitioners who've actually moved to be close to the monastery. And then there are other local people who've become interested just through the presence of the monastery. And then there are people who maybe never be particularly interested. And so one of the things that occurred to me when I was there was a sort of, that it's not something, it's not just like, you know, we're going to be there and we're going to do our thing, our special Buddhist thing, and, you know, everybody else is doing their thing and not have any connection. But, you know, I realized that being there, I was kind of entering into a particular context. You know, partly the context of the previous people who lived there, who were people who everybody, it's a kind of area where everybody knows everybody. And so he was somebody who was, you know, quite well known and respected and appreciated, and who put a lot of energy into establishing the place as a sanctuary for wildlife. And I don't think he had in mind that he was establishing a sanctuary for Buddhist nuns. He was establishing a sanctuary for wildlife. There are many trees that were planted, and there are, I don't know, maybe 20 or 30 nesting boxes attached to the trees around the place, and different species of birds would, and actually it's interesting, because when you go around and you look at the nesting boxes, they're slightly different sizes and shapes, and apparently you build quite specific designs for nesting boxes for different species of birds. But I mean, I haven't learned about that yet. It's one of the things I suppose I shall get to know about. But encouraging the red squirrels and the particular kinds of animals. The time I was there, just getting to know the different neighbours and incredible characters of the different people who live round about, and very nice just to sort of begin to get a feeling for the context that we'll be entering into, and the kind of concerns of the local people. And it's interesting that the previous owner, who actually died just after the property was sold, apparently he was very happy that the Sangha were going to be making use of it, because you know, he realized that we would have similar interests and values, you know, similar sensitivity to the environment and the natural world, and similar respect. And his daughter, actually, who showed us around, you know, she told me that one of the people who'd come to look at the house, and one of the things I asked her, actually, if we were going around, there were these enormous slugs that I noticed on the pathways in the woodland, and really big, fat, happy, healthy-looking slugs. And I commented about these, and she mentioned that one of the other people who'd been around had sort of had a similar observation, but their concern was not for sort of how fat and healthy and happy they looked, but was, you know, that they were going to do a lot of damage and that they would soon get rid of them. And so, of course, that they weren't people who this family were particularly interested in having buy the property. But they were very glad when they realised that we were interested, and apparently he actually Googled us and decided that we would be all right. And so he was very glad when he actually died that this was what was going to happen. So it was very, you know, I feel glad that we have this possibility for the sisters, because, you know, at the moment we live at Amrawati in Chithurst, which I can't say how glad I am that we have these monastic communities, and how happy I am actually living either at Chithurst or here. I don't mind where I stay. And yet a sense that it will be nice to have an alternative, you know, another place where the nuns also can spend time and hopefully be able to live a little bit more quietly. I mean, I'm very glad that Amrawati offers opportunities for so many people to come, and it makes me really happy to see so many people here this evening, and, you know, to think about the retreat centre, where I was reading in our some English Sangha Trust notes that, you know, 700 people come on retreat each year and have an opportunity to come and be here and to receive teachings and practice, develop their meditation. I mean, it's amazing. And at Chithurst also, you know, many, many people come. And it's not that I'm saying that I don't want many people to come to Milne Tuam, but the idea of having a place that is, you know, a little bit more remote and a little bit quieter, and to sort of for us to figure out ways that people can visit and be supported, and yet to be able to find a way that, you know, in some sense is a sense of protection for the sisters, so they can, you know, have an opportunity to practice in a more secluded, quiet place, and where there are fewer duties. I mean, other than the central duty that each one of us has to put these teachings into practice, to liberate the heart. It's useful to keep that in mind because, you know, say, especially here at Amrawati, all of us, you know, whether monk, nun, or lay person, there are many things we need to attend to. You know, concerns about the grounds, sort of cutting the grass, taking care of the trees, the flower beds, taking care of the buildings, the maintenance. And then recently, as you all know, we've had the kitchen refurbished. And we have this really super-duper kitchen, which has been redesigned according to quite particular specifications from the authorities, actually, the insurance people and the health and safety people. There's a lot of concern about, you know, really making sure that all of the health and safety rules are complied with, you know, so that we don't get poisoned or whatever. And so a lot of care and thought has been put into, you know, planning, designing, and then, you know, maintaining the kitchen in a way that is going to support the well-being of the community and, you know, enable us to continue as a place of practice. You know, so all the kind of regulations and, you know, seeing how we can really support these being followed and so on. So a lot of things that we have to consider about, quite worldly things. And in the midst of all of this, to look into the heart, you know, how is it right now? Chandasiri, may you be well. And for each one of you, you know, Caro, may you be well. Venerable Vanita, may you be well. Tim, may you be well. And just that each one of us, just to learn how to keep coming back, you know, to this moment, to this heart, You know, wherever we are, whatever we're doing, because that's the priority, just supporting, maintaining well-being for ourselves in our own hearts. And as we do this, as we develop this sense of tenderness, of care and concern, you know, sort of protecting the heart from all of the things that can cause harm, you know, all of the negativity, all of the ill will, you know, however right it is, you know, however justified it is, you know, we realize that dwelling in those states doesn't support well-being. You know, you might have a kind of sense of, kind of ego satisfaction, you know, especially if everybody agrees. But is it really a state of true happiness and joyfulness? So just looking to what supports well-being in our own hearts, and then finding ways to support and encourage one another. You know, sometimes when I talk to people, they sort of say, "Well, how do you know what I was thinking? You know, can you read minds?" And I say, "No, of course I can't read minds, but I know about my own suffering. You know, I know about the kind of things that make me happy, and the kind of things that make me miserable. I'm interested in supporting well-being, whether it's in myself or whether it's in somebody else." So it seems to happen quite naturally. You know, everything affects everything. I've just been reading a book by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and this is a book about science and nature. I mean, I can't understand a lot of it, but one of the things that's coming through to me that's kind of making an impression is just the sense of how interconnected everything is. You know, we might think that we're separate and that we can cut ourselves off from everybody, you know, hold ourselves in and protect ourselves. And sometimes we need to protect ourselves. I'm not denying that. You know, sort of, particularly, I don't know, after a retreat, if we've become very kind of open and soft and sensitive, you know, if we have to then go back to London or back to some very, very busy, difficult, challenging, demanding situation where people aren't practicing according to the precepts that we've undertaken, where they don't have a vow to cultivate harmlessness, you know, sometimes we do have to be a little bit, you know, protected, careful. But it's interesting just to sort of consider how we affect each other, and to realize that, you know, just a smile can actually make all the difference to somebody. You know, if somebody's struggling and obviously having a difficult time, just, you know, looking at them and smiling can gladden the heart. I know it gladdens my heart when somebody smiles or is kind. So just to consider just how very little things can make a difference. Sometimes I read the quotations on the calendar. I mean, I don't know if you've noticed in the office, there's a little calendar on the desk. And the quote, not sure if it was for Friday the 13th, it might have been for the day, was something like, you know, there are seldom occasions to do something great, of great benefit to people. But every day, there are countless opportunities to do small things that can make life better for somebody else. So this is something we can consider, and I don't know about you, but when I do something kind for somebody else, I usually feel a little bit better too. It has a double benefit. So for some of us, you know, this evening we have this opportunity for those who can to carry on the practice until midnight, and some people will need to return or maybe need to rest earlier. I mean, that's fine, whatever. And for those who have a chance to continue their practice, you know, recognizing that for some people, They may find states of great calm arising in their mind. Strong samadhi, jhana, all the rest of it, and that would be something to celebrate. And for other people it may just be a matter of actually being patient with the mind, with the body, just as they are, with the intention, may this being be well. Chandasiri, may you be well. And just beginning to cultivate that habit of presence, of kindness. So these are just a few reflections, contemplation, and for some people it may not make any sense and may not be useful, and that's fine. Please just set it to one side. And if there's anything there that's been helpful, then please feel free to pick it up and use it as a support for your practice. And may everyone be free. Thank you.